Welcome to our monthly Q&A with Kim and Jim. In this episode, they tackle questions like why cannabis makes certain people anxious, whether brain training is real, and if the brain can heal from chronic alcoholism. If you have a question you'd like answered in a future Q&A, you can send your question to mindingthebrainpodcast@gmail.com. We hope you enjoy the episode, and we look forward to reading your questions.
All right, hello and welcome to Live Minding the Brain. For those of you watching the video, we have a live studio audience. It's not canned laughter, so you got to laugh when we make jokes. And there have been questions sent in ahead of time, and we're going to start with them. So our first question is there any way for the brain to trick itself into learning something faster, like through the use of positive reinforcement or psychological tricks? I think everybody can, you know, think of times when they've had more fun learning something or been more productive because of something they did. A lot of apps have learning gamified, right? So Duolingo and other apps try to make, getting questions right more fun with little dings and whistles and colors. And you can gamify things in your own life too. If you wanted to study something, maybe you could reward yourself if you study that day or something like that. It's almost like a gamification. It's also a positive reinforcement. But also, you know, ways to learn if you can make it social, right? If you learn with friends, if you wanted to learn a sport or learn linear algebra or something, you could find somebody else who also wanted to do it. And social support always makes you more like compliant to do something. And the last thing I'll say is doing it every day. Some people have a tendency to postpone any kind of activity, not just learning, but any kind of activity until they feel like they have like a big chunk of time. And I'm not a fan of that strategy. In general, I think that it sometimes just never happens. But also, if you do it every day or at least every other day, it keeps that information in your mind, in your working memory, in your it's easier to study next time if you can remember what you studied before. So if you're really serious about learning something, I would try to make it social, gamify it, and make a habit out of it by doing it every day.
So the next question is, why do some people get anxious when they use cannabis, but others don't? And if I had the answer to that, I think I would be very happy, because it is a question I've been trying to answer as well with some of the research that I've been doing in my lab. So for those of you that know, I run a cannabis research lab here at Carleton. And it's a puzzling one. And I will say there's a couple things that we do know. So first of all, how anxious you get. First of all, it depends on if you're a novice user. So people who have never used cannabis before are more likely to get a very quick high compared to somebody who's a regular user and has developed a lot of some degree of tolerance to cannabis products. The next piece that's really relevant is dose. So the higher the potency of THC, which is the main psychoactive ingredient in cannabis products, the more likely you are to get anxious, and in fact, also more likely to get paranoid. Again, that does also depend on individual differences. So there's definitely something interesting where some people get more anxious and more paranoid, and some people actually have anxiety relief. And we know that, in fact, that anxiety relief tends to be one of the main reasons that contributes to a cannabis use disorder, meaning people are more likely to have daily or near daily use. When they feel anxious, they use cannabis. The cannabis relieves the anxiety. This is a negative reinforcing mechanism, as you all in psychology, neuroscience, and cognitive science are well familiar with those mechanisms of action. There's probably also genetic differences to some degree. We know that there are genetic polymorphisms for some of the cannabinoid receptors, as well as the proteins, the main endocannabinoid signaling molecules, so AEA, 2AG, and CB1 and CB2, which are the main receptors that bond these endogenous cannabinoids. And so there with certain copies of those genes, that may mean that you have enhanced activity of those receptors versus decreased activity of those receptors. So that's, again, one possible mechanism by which some people might have a more anxiety or anxiogenic response relative to others who have a more anxiolytic response. But I think what we need to have are broad, massive studies where we're actually doing a whole biomarker profile. So including things like gene expressions, gene expression as well as epigenetic changes. So experience of trauma, gender, sexuality, all these elements are really critical in informing individual differences. For a while, I thought it had something to do with ADHD. I thought there was like something happening with people who use who have ADHD and not, and how that relates to their effects of cannabis. But the good news is there's lots of things out there still for me to research. So
yeah, no. So if we have any super rich billionaires listening to the show and want to fund a study,
yeah,
Kim can spend your money.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the next question is, how does the brain process emotions and why can certain emotions feel so overwhelming? So I would have given this question to Kim if the word process hadn't been in there. Like how the brain does emotions.
I was like, why is Jim answering this?
Well, yeah, because
this had the word brain in it.
It did have the word brain in it. But process, the term processing emotions is a specific thing that I've been reading about a lot lately, which is like how do you sort of deal with your emotions? How do you work through them? So I decided to take a stab at it. But Kim could talk at length about the limbic system, whatever. I'll talk briefly about the limbic system. But I will say that emotions are very ancient. They are shared with many other animals. And they use parts of the brain that are evolutionarily older. And what that means is that we see similar brain structures in more animals that are more distant from us in the evolutionary tree. As opposed to the evolutionarily newer parts of our brains, the cortex, particularly the frontal areas. And so the processing of emotions often is about what do you do in terms of making decisions with acts of will or using your sort of conscious, deliberate mind to try to manage and regulate your emotions. And that is generally like a frontal cortical thing. That part of your brain can try to reduce the activation in the limbic system and try to ignore emotions or distract yourself from emotions. And these different strategies are what sometimes get called emotional regulation or how you might try to process it. So if you're feeling really frightened about something, you can try to do various strategies to reduce that unpleasant emotion. If you think that the fear is getting in your way, you can, you know, deliberately try to do deep breathing or think about something else that would be like a distraction. Or you can just try to ignore it or push it down or suppress it is another way that it sometimes gets described. And it's harder to describe it in more detail about what that actually means, but most people have an idea of what it kind of means to push down or like ignore or suppress an emotion. And another thing you can do is change your narrative about it, right? So this is a very high-level cognitive reframing, and this is the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy, where you try to think different thoughts about the emotion, right? So you might have the fear, but sort of situate that fear as part of some larger story or meaning in your life that makes it a little less awful. So you're still feeling the fear, but it's maybe a little less unpleasant because you've situated it differently. Similarly with gratitude exercises, you know, you might feel really bad about, you know, you just got dumped by your partner or whatever, but, you know, you don't have to worry about bandits on your way to Carlton, you know, and that's something.
Or pirates.
Pirates, also bad, you know, on the canal, there are no pirates. So, you know, this is something a lot of people in history had to worry about every time they would travel, right? But we don't. So just resituating and reframing, and that's what I would say about processing of emotion.
And I would also add, like, the reason why they can feel so overwhelming is probably because evolutionary, they serve such an important purpose in guiding us in terms of approaching things that are important for our survival and avoiding things that are threatening our survival, that there's a lot of pathways in the brain that are alerting us to paying attention to this, because for the most part, these things have been meaningful and they have been informing our survival. So that's why I would, my guess is why they feel so overwhelming. Literally the word feeling comes from the fact that a lot of the emotions are actually processed by areas of the brain that are involved in touch sensitivity as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. If you want to learn more about the evolution of emotion, there's a great book called Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, which is a really neat look at psychiatry from an evolutionary perspective and emotions and that kind of thing.
That's cool. So the next question is, can the brain heal from chronic alcohol use? So I have the good news and I have the bad news. Which do we want to hear first? The good news. Okay.
Oh, I saw a thumbs down over there.
Oh, okay. So. All right. So we'll start with the good news. So yes, the brain can heal, right? The brain is plastic. You've heard this before, that there is constant changing happening in your brain because of the neurogenesis that happens, the birth of new cells all throughout, well into our adulthood. That this is why we can still learn, right? We can still learn well up into our 80s and 90s and even the 100s, right? If we have good cognitive functioning. And if somebody is attempting to have abstinence or not using alcohol, there's definitely a healing of the brain, meaning that we're going to have a rebalancing of those circuits in the brain that we know are implicated in chronic substance use. So the reward system, the fear system, we're going to have when we engage in coping strategies outside of substance use, that's a learning process that's happening, and the brain is changing. And the good news story is there's many, many people living very well in recovery from chronic alcohol use. Will the addiction still be there? Of course, right? What I always say when I teach my classes is we may not remember what we ate for breakfast last Tuesday when we're in our 90s, but are we going to remember the first time that we smoked crack cocaine or drank alcohol or existed in a very alcohol or substance using state? Absolutely, right? Those memories are pretty darn permanent. But that doesn't mean that those memories dominate and take control such that we are living in struggle all the time. So that's the good news, right? So yes, the brain can heal. Do we go back to what we were before we consumed alcohol? No. But why would we want to? Because when we have a chronic substance use disorder, the person that was before that substance use started was not in a great place. So what we do is we move forward and we develop new connections and new identity around living well in the absence of substance use. The bad news is that in some cases, people who consume a lot of alcohol, and in fact, to the point where most of their calories are coming from alcohol and they're not consuming a varied diet, what this means is that that person is also suffering from malnutrition. And one of the side effects of a malnourished, alcohol-prone diet is you're not getting sufficient amounts of vitamin B1 or thiamine. And a chronic loss of vitamin B1 is actually neurotoxic, and it kills off specific populations of cells that are involved in learning and memory, an area of the brain known as the mammillary bodies. If it's caught early enough, you can replace with thiamine substitution in the diet and you regain function. If it is not caught early enough, you can have permanent, lifelong deficits in learning and memory, and that is what's called Korsakoff syndrome. So Korsakoff syndrome is a very specific form of dementia that is indirectly due to alcohol use and directly due to loss of thiamine. It can also happen, by the way, with people who have eating disorders and who don't may have binge eating disorder, anorexia, don't consume enough food and nutrition to support brain function. And one of the interesting things about Korsakoff syndrome that I remember learning about it and teaching about it is one of the markers of Korsakoff's is patients will do what's called confabulation. Not sure if you guys have heard of that term before, but it's a specific form of lying where a patient won't be able to remember something like, oh, dad, didn't we play chess yesterday? And the dad doesn't remember playing chess, but they actually start lying about what they don't remember about playing chess. So they're confabulating, so they're making up stories to account for their memory loss. And it's a kind of a unique feature of Korsakoff syndrome. So that's the good news, bad news, that the brain can indeed heal itself, certainly from a substance use disorder. But of course, there are some other challenges associated with chronic alcohol use that affect not only certain organs like your liver, but also can affect your brain.
All right, next question. How does our brain create a sense of continuity in our own personal experience? How do we maintain a constant sense of self despite changes in our thoughts and feelings? That was a deep one. And I think the short answer is memory. I'm going to tell you a story about a guy named Clive Waring, who is a composer, who lost the ability to form new short-term memories. And it was very severe. So about every 20 seconds, his memory would reset. So he couldn't have long conversations or anything. And he wrote in a diary for, I think, 27 years. And it would have entries like, I'm going to read here, 8:31 a.m. Now I am really completely awake for the first time. 9:06 a.m. Now I am perfectly overwhelmingly awake for the first time. 9:34. Now I am superlatively actually awake for the first time. This went on for 20 years. Because if you can't remember what happened 20 seconds ago, it kind of feels like waking up, right? What is the feeling of waking up? It's kind of not remembering what just happened. And when you can never remember what just happened, it's this constant feeling of waking up, which means that there's really not a sense of continuity. In my class, I show a video of a woman who's temporarily lost her ability to form memories. And she's talking to her daughter, and this conversation is like a loop. Just keeps saying almost the same exact things over and over again. And so really, a lot of your sense of self and who you are is based on your memory. And without it, you end up just responding very similarly over and over again. And you lose the sense of being a person over time. Clive, for example, couldn't really remember having met people. And, you know, there are interviews you can watch of him saying, you know, I haven't talked to anyone in 20 years. Just felt like he hadn't. Luckily, he still loved his wife. And every time she would walk in the room or every 20 seconds, he would act like he hadn't seen her in years and just like be so overjoyed and hug her. It's very sweet. I always tell people when I talk about this, that if this ever happens to me, I want you to like run stand-up comedy specials and measure how much I laugh. And when you find the one I laugh at the most, just put it on loop. And just let me live the rest of my life laughing like crazy for the rest of my life. I will also say that we also tend to, like the question says, despite our changes in our thoughts and feelings, but there is a bias that people tend to think that they're more consistent than they actually are. If you keep diaries and you ever read back to a long time ago, particularly when you get to middle age or older and you start reading about things you wrote when you were, you know, in your 20s or teens or whatever, you're often very shocked at the views you had and the attitudes you had. And you're like, God, I thought that. Many times people will change their mind and then they'll just feel like they've always had that view when actually they haven't. So, you know, maybe that also helps give us a sense of a continuous self. We actually forget how different we used to be.
Next question is, what does the research say about the relationship between physical exercise and brain health? Can staying active help prevent cognitive decline? So we do have a whole episode on this, episode 8 on exercise. So it's way back in the Minding the Brain archives if you're interested. But I'm happy to give you the Cole's notes because this is actually a topic that I'm quite passionate about. And even though it has nothing to do with my research area, I kind of did a deep dive into exercise in the brain when I was preparing for my lectures for the old 1202 class, which used to be called 1201. And in a nutshell, exercise is amazing for your brain. Your brain is an organ. Just like every other organ of your body, it benefits from you moving. So your heart, your lungs, everything is better when we're moving. And the reason for why your brain really benefits is because your brain is a metabolically hungry organ. It demands a lot of blood flow to function properly. And so when we're exercising, particularly if you're engaging in aerobic exercise, that's 60 to 70% of your maximum heart rate. So things like running, kayaking, some degree of bodybuilding if you're maintaining your heart rate. And if you're doing that for a significant amount of time, that's pumping a ton of blood up into your brain. Like, you know, when you're panting, you're out of breath because you're working out. That's what's happening, is your heart is pumping. You're pumping all that blood up into your brain. And what's happening at that point is you're upregulating, you're pumping up oxygen and glucose up into your brain. That's benefiting all those cells, right? That's what they need to work and function normally. At the same time, what it's doing is upregulating key proteins that are involved not only in cell repair, but also the vasculature of your brain. So you're upregulating things like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, a nerve growth factor, vesicular endothelial growth factor. So literally these trophins that are the building blocks of your brain. So when you're increasing these growth factors, what that's doing is it's allowing for that increased synaptic plasticity. And so I talked earlier about synaptic plasticity being a key in recovery from substance use disorders. It's also key in mood. And we know that people who have mood dysregulations have decreased synaptic plasticity. If you go on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications and psychedelics, boom, you get this massive boost in synaptic plasticity that is the mechanism is through increased growth factor regulation. So all that is to say, exercise is amazing for your mood. It has been extremely beneficial for mild to moderate depression. It's not great for severe depression or anxiety. It never hurts. But for that, definitely I would recommend psychotherapy as well as pharmacotherapy. It is also great for cognition. And that's, right, the main outcomes of the brain. It helps with your mood, helps with your cognitive state. So learning and memory is benefited when we go out for a run, right? If you're feeling, you're sitting at your desk and you're studying and you feel like you're super sluggish, go for a brisk walk around the block, get that blood flow to your brain, and you're going to be much more alert and ready to pay attention to tackle more of your studying. And there's also rich research that shows that people who exercise primarily, interestingly, in midlife, so people like me, that is associated with a decreased likelihood of the development of things like dementias. So Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, you're less likely to develop these if you have a history of regular aerobic activity in midlife. So the best time to start those, I didn't start running until I was in grad school. Before that, I was like a bit of a sloth, not gonna lie. I never engaged in sport. That wasn't who I was. It's not part of my identity. I remember I went out for my first run when I was a graduate student. So I was like 23, 24, and I ran for 12 minutes. I was like, this is amazing. I thought I was like, oh, look at me. And then within a year, I was racing 5Ks. By the time I finished my PhD, I was racing triathlons. When I was doing my postdoc, I was a running instructor. And it wasn't until then that I developed my identity around somebody who engages in exercise. But I can tell you that I credit a lot of my mental health and just overall ability to manage life with regular exercise. So that's why I'm super passionate about it. I think it's an amazing thing. And you all being young, half my age, great time to start those exercise habits if you haven't already.
Okay, next question is, are there any brain training exercises or techniques you personally recommend for improving mental clarity or focus? So Kim just gave you a big dissertation about exercise, and that's great. I want to talk about stuff that you don't hear about as much, okay? But yes, absolutely, sleep, good sleep, exercise, social activity, get those under control. But brain training, so the things that people normally think of are these apps. I haven't seen a lot of ads for them lately. Maybe
no,
they've died
right.
out, like Lumosity.
Lumosity.
They're terrible. Like
Livin. Have you seen these?
They
Livin
don't
apps?
Work. Yeah, they don't work. They don't work.
Take that out, Mike.
Very well.
Get me.
What's the matter? Did you?
No, I'm just afraid these people are going to come sue me for like saying that they don't work.
What could be cooler than getting sued by Lumosity? Okay, so anyway, the brain training things don't work. I like to point out that there's much better evidence that first-person shooter video games are better for your brain than these brain training apps. And they're certainly more fun. So if you're going to do anything like that, just play Half-Life or something. But brain training exercises. All right, so some of the things, like using your brain and processing things deeply and getting into a habit of that is very good for your brain. So For example, if you read something, right? Writing about it, how do you feel about it? How does it relate to other things you know? Talk to somebody about it. This is deep processing, and you get in practice of different ways of thinking and looking at things that become tools that your mind can use later. So as you're learning things in university or on your own, you're often developing a whole bunch of strategies and different ways to approach new problems in your life that make you more effective and competent at using your mind and your brain. Even if you're doing something that most people consider a waste of time, like, you watch some stupid video on YouTube, right? What can you make out of that? Well, you can pause it and you can think, how could I make that better? How could that be a surrealist piece? What music would I put to that? There's all kinds of stuff. You know, you go to an art gallery, and even if it's you don't like the art gallery, the museum, and you're bored, you can make things like for yourself, like which if I had to have one in my house, which one would it be? If I was going to sell that, what would I ask for it? Something like this. Just like constantly thinking about things. I had a friend who was a theater director, and she was really great, and she would just sit and listen to music. But unlike most people, she would sit there and compose music videos in her head. How would I make the music video for this song, right? And just constantly exercising her mind and thinking about this kind of thing. I'm trying to give you some like less known ways to, and I think very fun, just get your mind in a creative state of deep processing and thinking about how it relates to you or art or something like that.
Pause. Does anybody do this like when they're reading novels? Does anybody read novels anymore? Like I'm reading The Fourth Wing. Okay, I know, Dragon Smut. And whenever I read like a book I really love, I imagine like casting, like who would be the characters that I would, the actors that I would cast. Anybody else do this? And like I actually sometimes have like visuals of what I imagine certain scenes
the and sets
how
and stuff?
I would, how I, the shots I would do to I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah.
World building.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So would that count?
Yeah, but it sounds like it's coming to you naturally. And I'm suggesting if you want an exercise, right, you could like flesh it out. You can make storyboards. You could revise it. You could think maybe it would be better with this camera angle or like how would the character be different if it were this actor or something like that, you know? People vary a lot in how much they do spontaneous visualization while they're reading fiction. I actually don't have a lot of visual experience when I read. But some people, it's almost like a movie in their head.
Yes, that's me. Can I also offer another brain training exercise or technique would be put your phone away. I just read a report showing the percentage, this is American data, but I don't think Canadian data would be too different, the percentage of Americans who have struggled to focus and concentrate. And it was like this, like flat till 2008, and is on a steady incline in terms of the sheer number of people who say that they cannot focus or concentrate. And a lot of that relates to how we're engaging with our smartphones and, very short form media content. Thank you for listening to this long form podcast.
Those of you still here.
Those of you still listening haven't put us on 3.2 speed. But there is good evidence to say actually turning off your phone if you want to do something with focus. It's not even enough just to be in your back pocket and on silent. Literally turn it off or put it in a completely different room if you want to learn to concentrate and focus more or better. So that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, they've actually done studies where even just having your phone on your desk face down is a distraction. You're just constantly thinking about checking it. So I like to teach that if you can concentrate on one thing and work hard on one thing with focus, it's like a superpower in today's world. It'll give you an advantage 100%. Over everybody else.
Yeah.
So it's not just for, you know, it actually will give you an advantage with that. I'm not going to put my phone away because we're using it to record, but otherwise I would.
Yeah.
Kim's phone is out.
I know. My daughter's messaging me.
Flip it over. You need to flip it. Let's put it under the hippocampus book.
She's asking me for more time on on Instagram. I know, the irony, right?
Yeah. She's bugging you, distracting you with your phone so she can have more time on her phone.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's very meta. Okay.
Love it.
What are some of the biggest myths about the brain that you wish people would stop believing? So I don't know if some of you caught the reel that DUC, University Communications, put out today. One of my pet peeve myths is dopamine.
Did they perpetuate
detox?
A myth? Or
no, they had me myth busting.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah. Thank God. They had me like ripping a piece of paper. It was rather dramatic. dopamine detoxes. Boom. So yeah, that's one that is... Like, I've been asked about dopamine detoxes for, well, like, 5 years now. I think it started in Silicon Valley, like, this sort of wellness hub of, like, people trying to hack your brain. Anyway, so if you're interested in that, and I did answer that in one of our last Q&As. So dopamine detoxes. Only using 10% of your brain. I don't know. I don't know who believes that anymore. Like, I think most people, like, certainly students that are in the field recognize that that's a myth. The other one, like anything like wellness and the brain needing supplements, that drives me bananas. Like our bodies are fine-tuned. They have evolved for millennia to do the things, right? To get rid of the toxins from our body and to, you know, as long as we have a varied diet, to actually have the appropriate amino acids that are required for normal brain function. So it kind of gets me when there's like grifters that are out there capitalizing on people's fear and that, you know, there's going to be something out there that'll be better for them. So that...
And I just want to check with you, is because the microdosing hallucinogens has not fared well in studies, right?
Yeah, it's placebo.
Right. So, yeah, that would be one of my big brain myths mm-hmm. I'd want to bust is that mm-hmm. microdosing is doesn't do anything more than a good sugar pill.
Like CBD for anxiety. No. Sorry. Like, yeah, burst your bubble. Not doing anything.
Okay.
Go.
Next one. What happens in the brain when we experience a gut feeling? How does intuition work from a neurological standpoint? So the way I look at gut feelings is that it is when your mind, like the answer to something just pops into your head and you have no idea where it came from or what. As opposed to when you sort of reason something out and you think step by step and you're like, okay, this, then this. Okay, well, this must be true. Sometimes you just get a feeling, I trust this person, or I'm attracted to this person, or this seems fishy to me, or something like that. And generally, scientists explain this in terms of, most of what's going on in the brain is unconscious. So consciousness is what you know of going on in your brain, and it's a very, very limited resource. It's hard to describe, but the best way I've seen to describe it is that it can only hold one consistent view of the world at a time. Okay. So, this is why I can be conscious of you and the wall and this, because it's all part of a coherent scene. But if you do something as simple as show a different color to each eye, your consciousness fluctuates between them because like the two colors are incompatible. And so there's this competition of the stuff going on in your brain. Some of it you can't be conscious of. Okay. Like you can't, your brain controls hormone release into the bloodstream. You can't be conscious of your hormone release as far as I've ever seen evidence for, but there are things you could be conscious of, but you're often not. So there's this like, there's this filtering that goes on where somehow we don't know exactly how it works. Some stuff becomes conscious and other stuff does not. It has to do with attention shifting, has to do with a lot of stuff. But sometimes the result of a mind process, a brain process, will make it into consciousness, but the process itself does not. So you might end up with a feeling like, oh, that doesn't make sense. I'll give an example. My dad was a lawyer, and we were walking around Atlanta, where I went to grad school, and he saw a sign that said, no cruising. For those of you who don't know, cruising is something that was very popular in the 90s, particularly with the African-American community of driving slowly, you know, having a good time. And my dad said, that's unconstitutional. And I said, really? Why? And he said, I can't explain it right now, but I'm sure I could figure it out. I just know it was. And his experience with the Constitution was so extensive that his mind could come to that conclusion. And he was confident that as soon as he started saying it would all like come out. It had become like an intuition. A lot of the stuff that can't be conscious, we refer to as system one. Okay, there's this very popular theory that separates basically the deliberate, slow, conscious processing as a system two, and the older unconscious, fast-moving process as system one. That's called system one because it came first in evolution. And so a lot of the things that happen in system one, if you become conscious of its result, is something we might call an intuition. And final thing I'll say is that often your intuitions, your intuitive thoughts, are based on maybe instinct, some proclivity that is more or less genetic because you're human or because of, maybe some trait, genetic trait that you have. But anything that is overlearned or learned really, really well can also become like an intuition where you're not aware of the processing, kind of like my dad and knowing that banning cruising was unconstitutional. And the tricky thing is that you don't really know which one it is by feeling, right? So if you are talking to a job candidate and you think that they're unqualified, you might not know if it's an intuition you should trust because they're doing something that's actually untrustworthy, or maybe you're being prejudiced in some way. They might be, maybe it's because it's a woman or minority. Mm-hmm. And you just get a feeling that they're less qualified, and it could be, learned prejudices from the environment. So I think that, you know, questioning your intuitions is an incredibly important thing to do. I saw somebody with a sweatshirt once that said, always trust your gut. I'm like, wow, that is terrible advice. That is really, really bad because, you know, we picked up biases that aren't good for us in our culture, both because of, you know, prejudices and this thing, but also just we're barraged with advertising all the time, you know? If you trusted your intuition with what you ate, you'd be very unhealthy, for example, right? Just eat what tastes good or whatever. So, that's how I explain gut feelings.
Have you read the paper by Gazzaniga, making the advantageous decision before being aware of the advantageous decision?
No.
It is wild. You guys know the Iowa gambling task?
Remind us.
Yeah, the four decks of cards. Two are good decks, two are bad decks, meaning if you pick from them randomly, you'll win less, but over time you'll actually you pay out a little bit, but you win a lot over time. Whereas the risky or bad decks, it looks like you win a lot, but over time you actually lose a lot as well. People don't know which deck is what, and they're just told make as much money as possible. So they're picking randomly from all the decks. And initially, people pick from the bad decks because they're like, oh, I win a lot. But then over time, you're losing a lot of money, so you switch and you move to the so-called good decks. And Gazzaniga hooked people up to like galvanic skin response, heart rate. So he's measuring your autonomic nervous system responses. And what he found was that people, before they were consciously aware that deck A and B were the good decks, their autonomic nervous system would be reacting to the bad decks. So before they even switched over their behavior to preferentially selecting the good decks, their brain and body was responding to the bad decks. You see what I mean? So people, that this is the intuition. This is that gut feeling. Your gut feeling is these decks are bad, right? System one is saying that. And I would say that's the autonomic nervous system. Before system two, your decision-making, your conscious choice was making the choices. And I would also add to that, gut feelings are also the vagal nerve. That is like when we have gut feelings, sometimes our autonomic nervous system is signaling down via our vagal nerve to our stomach. So sometimes we have these butterflies in our stomach or just this gut feeling.
Right. If we want to literally talk about gut feelings. Yeah. Feelings in your stomach. Have their own neural
connection.
Like a whole neural system, right? Mm-hmm. It's called the enteric
nervous system,
right?